Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up on a dry farm in Idaho and earned a BA in finance from Utah State University and an MBA in finance from Brigham Young. From 2000 to 2015, he held various senior leadership positions at Leucadia National Corporation. Since 2015, he's been the CEO of Berkadia Commercial Mortgage LLC, which has a servicing portfolio of $210 billion, that's with a B, dollars. His name, Justin Wheeler. And I'm Jack Prasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Prasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Justin Wheeler, the CEO of Berkadia Commercial Mortgage LLC. Justin, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. It's great to be here.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Sure. I grew up in a really small town called Ryrie, Idaho, which is about, the best way of saying it's about 50 miles west of Jackson Hole, Wyoming. I grew up on a dry farm, which means that while the rich potato farmers were celebrating their many victories, we were on the sidelines praying that it would rain. And unfortunately, in Idaho, it didn't rain enough. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. She was always there when I got off the school bus, and my dad was always in the field or working on some piece of machinery that never seemed to run as it should. But those were great memories. And as my grandpa used to say, farming is a wonderful life, but a terrible way to make a living.
Justin, what's the biggest thing you learned from mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from dad?
I'd kind of say probably the same thing for both of them, Jack. My mom and my dad were both extremely hard workers, and my dad was very passionate about farming and loved being, one with nature, loved being outside, loved everything about it. And my mom was just worked very, very hard. And so I probably learned a little bit of, hey, do what you love, find something you really like to do and can be passionate about. And then when you are doing it, make sure you're working really hard at it.
You no doubt worked many long hours with mom and dad on those farms. What's the biggest thing you learned farming as a kid?
I learned that sometimes things just don't work out. I can remember really well, I was probably 14 or 15, and my dad and I drove in our old beat-up pickup out to look at this field. We had about 320 acres of fall wheat that we were looking at and about to pull the harvester in there probably within the next couple of days. And as we're sitting watching this crop of fall wheat, we're just kind of watching the wind blow through it and saying, man, that's going to be an amazing harvest. A cloud rolled over, a big hailstorm happened and knocked all of the grain, the heads off of the wheat down to the ground. And my dad kind of turned to me and said, well, instead of getting the harvester, I guess we're going to go get the plow. And that taught me two things. One, it doesn't always work out. And two, I probably wasn't cut out for farming.
Great lesson, though, for running major organizations, that's for sure. You went to Brigham Young to get a master's. Everybody knows about Brigham Young. Tell us something special about Brigham Young University.
Oh, I had a wonderful time. I applied for a couple of different places and got into a few that were bigger and maybe potentially a little bit better known. But I had the dean who ran the business school was just a really special guy who promised to kind of take me under his wing and allow me opportunities that I would have got at any other school. And I think the size, there were relatively fewer number of students, and so it was nice to have a little more one-on-one, a little more small class feel and attention with the professors.
While you were there, you had to devote 2 years of your life on LDS mission. Tell us about the countries you served.
So that was 2 years. That was between the ages of 19 and 21. And I went to France, was in Paris for a couple of months, and then dropped down to Bordeaux for another couple of months. Then I took a long plane flight. And by the way, this is probably my second plane flight of my life was when I went from Salt Lake City to Paris. And then went dropped down to Reunion Island, which is off the coast of Africa. It's a French protectorate. And then went over to Mauritius for a short period of time, which is its own independent country, part of the British Commonwealth. And then over to Madagascar, where I spent about 5 months, and then kind of wrapped it up back through South Africa and back to Little Ryrie, Idaho.
You went from Paris, you know, the arguably the greatest city in the world, to these very, very poor countries. Talk to us about the extreme poverty you saw in those two countries.
Yeah. So, you know, Reunion, being a French protectorate, was pretty in pretty decent shape. Mauritius as well had a lot of tourism and quite a bit of manufacturing, especially in textiles. But Madagascar truly was, Jack, a life-changing experience for me. I didn't grow up with very much money. That's certainly true, but that is, I learned quickly that is all relative. And got to spend a lot of time as a missionary. You're right in amongst the people, and got to spend a lot of time with the folks in Madagascar. And, you know, everything from, yellow fever and malaria and seeing people literally, you know, in the streets were suffering and dying from these conditions, to a lack of sanitation, to certainly a lack of food and proper clothing. That was kind of the case. I mean, Madagascar is an extremely interesting country, but very, very, we hear talk about the 1%, you know, there it's probably the 0.00001% who corner all the wealth of the country, and everyone else is extremely on the other end of the spectrum. And so for me, coming from where I came from, which I guess was decently sheltered, it was really an eye-opening experience.
When we were together, Justin, a few weeks ago, talking about Madagascar and the extreme poverty, you said, at the same time, Jack, the people were very happy and phenomenally grateful. Justin, why so?
It's a question I ask myself a lot, Jack, and it really was, I remember distinctly kind of walking through these little villages with the fences coming down, and no one, everyone's like kind of out just scavenging, trying to get enough to eat, and yet there'd be little kids who'd be running after us, just laughing and giggling. And, you know, if we turn around and looked at them or talked to them or shook their hand, I mean, they just got the biggest charge out of that and the biggest kick. And the parents were also seemed to be relatively happy, and despite either poor health or poor economic conditions. And it's something that's given me a lot of perspective, or at least I hope it's given me a lot of perspective as I've went through my life so far, is just how could those people, despite that, and what does that mean about me as I'm chasing down the American dream and as I'm trying to figure out how to get promoted and do bigger and better things? I mean, is that really the place where happiness is found? Or is it found somewhere else? And I do think that one of the things that was really amazing about the folks in Madagascar is they were really family-oriented. There was, I mean, every house you went to may have three or four generations of family living within it, and they were very, very close, and probably gives us some, maybe a little bit of insight into what's really important.
We're talking to Justin Wheeler, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Krasula, and we're with an amazing person with a phenomenal story, Justin Wheeler. Justin, I've heard it say that life is a series of chapters. You're a young man, and you've run a lumber company, a beef company, a nationwide car dealership, Pine Ridge Wine Company. How so?
Well, I wouldn't take the position that I ran all of those, but I certainly had oversight over those companies as part of my job at Leucadia National Corporation, which I was there from 2000 through 2015, as you mentioned in the intro. And, Leucadia is a very interesting company. Think of it as a private equity company, but as a publicly traded company. Started by a couple of partners back in the late 70s and really a fascinating story. But, we had one search, and that was for things that were opportunistically priced. And so as various economic cycles kind of went through the United States and various opportunities arose, they took advantage of those by buying value and really were somewhat, like you think about Warren Buffett, were certainly kind of value-oriented investors, and they managed and we managed together to cobble together a pretty interesting portfolio of assets, and then it was my privilege to work with the leaders of those companies and try to figure out how to get them to perform even better.
On August 30th, 2005, you closed a deal to purchase Hard Rock Casino in Biloxi, Mississippi. Justin, that was the day after Katrina hit. Tell us about those first couple days.
Yeah, no, it was shortly after Katrina hit, that's right. And what had happened, once again, and kind of consistent with the theme of trying to find value, after Katrina hit, they were unable to get their insurance proceeds put together. And so we came in and essentially bought what was left of the casino. It had the casino ripped off the front of it, and the hotel was underwater to some level. We came in and put up the money to start the remodel of the hotel and the casino, and then fought it out with the insurance company to get the proceeds over the next year or so, which we were successful in doing. And just really had an opportunity to come in and buy something that we believed had an intrinsic value much greater than what we needed to pay for it, and then worked as hard as we could to make sure that we realized the value out of that, and subsequently sold the company, I think, in 2013 or 14.
We're talking to Justin Wheeler. If you want to learn more, www.berkadia.com. You've made many acquisitions, Justin. What's the most unique one?
That's a great question. I think probably the acquisition of National Beef Packing Corporation, which was, a fun one for me, given my agricultural background. But this is the nation's fourth largest beef producer. In other words, a cow walks in the door and out the back goes a box of beef. And they process about 3 million head of cattle a year in two plants, one in Liberal, Kansas, and the other one in Dodge City, Kansas. But just a really interesting business that starts, with a heart in farming and has a lot of manufacturing to it. And then out the other side, there's sales and marketing and product. So really kind of almost the entire life cycle of what a business could be is all contained in one company. And I was able to work with all the way from kind of the farmers to the company management to be able to go through and tour the facilities and those sorts of things. And it was just it was really fun. And what usually makes these fun is what made this one the best, which is the people. And when you get around agriculture, it seems like you get around people who have their heart and their heads in the right place. And that certainly was true with National Beef.
In December 2009, Leucadia entered into a 50-50 joint venture with a company most of us have heard about, Berkshire Hathaway, to form Berkadia. How'd that come about, Justin?
Yeah, so essentially there was at one point in time, people may remember this as well, there was a GMAC, which was a division of General Motors, and this was the GMAC commercial mortgage arm of GMAC, and it was sold in 2006 to a group, Five Mile Capital, Goldman Sachs, KKR, all got together, and they bought this a portion of GMAC, and the idea was to, build it up and then take it public. And that we all remember, at least those of us old enough, remember 2008 and the economic turmoil there, and the company went into bankruptcy. At that point, it was called Capmark. And in bankruptcy, we were scrounging around trying to find things to buy, and in bankruptcy, we found Capmark. And worked through the bankruptcy process and were able to form, with Warren, we were able to put together and form a company and buy Capmark. And we, didn't want to spend any money on marketing, so we just took the Berk from Berkshire Hathaway and the ADF from Leucadia and shoved them together.
You mentioned bankruptcy judges. Not many of us really know about them, but they have unbelievable power. Tell us about bankruptcy judges.
Yeah, so, it's one place I've found where there is almost absolute power with no real opportunity to appeal. In the process of purchasing Capmark. We were in the bankruptcy process and worked with a judge, and we were, you know, we were put in the position where there was a competing bid, and the judge asked us to come back with bids in cash, both parties. And so one of us, being Leucadia, we showed up with a bid in cash, and the other entity came to the table with a bid that was not in cash, and the judge, without question and without overthinking it, quickly said, "I asked for this in cash. You didn't bring it in cash. Judgment, Leucadia." Bam, slams the gavel down, and the game was over.
Tell us about Bercadia, please.
Yeah, Bercadia, our company, we have about 1,600 employees, and we have kind of three business lines. The first is called investment sales, but think about it as Century 21 for apartment buildings. We are always looking for to be able to list and to sell apartment buildings. The second division that we have is mortgage banking. And this means that we are out originating financing for purchases of commercial real estate, so mortgages. If you buy an apartment building or you buy a warehouse or you buy a hotel or you buy any other sort of commercial real estate, we will try to find the partner to finance that for you. So in cases where it's multifamily housing, that might be Freddie or Fannie or HUD. But it also may be a number of insurance companies or a number of banks or debt funds or things like that. So we originate mortgages. And then the third division is the servicing divisions. And that is really where those mortgages that we create and others that we subservice will actually do all of the things they're required to do. And there's a lot of them. We collect the money from the payments. We make sure the interest gets paid. We make sure the principal gets paid to the investors. We make sure the taxes get paid and that there's insurance on the properties and all those sorts of things that we need to do. About 600, maybe slightly less than that, of our employees are in India, and about that leaves the remaining close to 1,000 who are in the United States with we have a good contingency and just outside of Philadelphia and in Dallas, Atlanta, Phoenix, but really spread out in about 45 offices nationwide.
Your servicing portfolio today is $210 billion with a B. You're the largest non-bank commercial loans servicer, but you're competing every day against Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Key, PNC, humongous banks. How do you do it?
Well, the good news is that the loans that we originate from our mortgage banking, we are, for the most part, able to service those. So it really, we really have the opportunity to bake our own bread, if you will. And what's really nice is while we're servicing loans, when those loans mature or when someone wants to pay those off or someone wants to sell one of the underlying buildings that has a mortgage on it, we have an investment sales arm where we can sell it. So I like to call Bercadia the virtuous circle because we can sell a building, we can finance a building, we can service the mortgage on that building, and then if it needs to be sold again, we can do that, or if it needs to be refinanced, we can do that. And we can keep a building, forever under our care if it works out that way.
We're talking to Justin Wheeler. When we come back, we're going to ask him about culture and Bercadia's culture. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula. We're with Justin Wheeler, CEO of Bercadia Commercial Mortgage LLC. I've heard it said, Justin, that culture will eat strategy for breakfast every day. Talk to us about culture, and what is your culture?
I actually, Jack, don't like to talk too much about culture because I think it's a word that's overused and it's misused. Because people really want to say, we're going to have a good culture. Let's do things to have a good culture. Let's create a good culture, those sorts of things. And I think that culture really is an outcome. And, what your culture is, people are interested in what you say, but they're really interested in what you do. And for me, the culture of a company or the culture of a family or the culture of a nation is really the result of the day-to-day decisions that we make and the day-to-day, you know, things that we do as a company. And so, you know, we've established values, a vision and values at Berkadia. Those are aspirational, certainly, and you can certainly find examples of where we fall short of what we're trying to do. But we try every day, and we strive every day to just narrow that gap a little bit between what we hope to be and how we hope to present ourselves and what we hope decisions we hope to make and what we really are doing. And that, you know, if you will, that effort to close that gap every day in every decision results, I think, in a culture that is healthy and one that people want to be part of.
We're talking to Justin Wheeler. Justin, you lead and as such serve 1,300 employees, 600 of which, as you mentioned, are in Hyderabad, India. Tell us about that portion of your team.
They're fantastic. So I can't say that we were smart enough to start that part of the organization. That was actually started just over 15 years ago by predecessor companies. But we, you know, when I came on board, I think in 2015, there were around 250, 300 people. We got up to, you know, now where we're close to 500, 600 people. And they're great. You know, it was originally thought of as kind of a labor arbitrage, which is, hey, we can get people to do some processing and we get them to do some data entry work and things like that at a lower wage scale than we can in the United States. That was certainly kind of the origins of it back 15 years ago. But what we've found in India is there's a very good set of folks who are highly educated. I think, you know, most over 70% of our employees have master's degrees or PhDs. You know, who are very anxious to learn and anxious to serve and anxious to help. And so we've really found that we can give them more and more responsibility within the organization, and they've been fantastic to work with. And it's a, you know, India is truly an amazing culture. When you talk about service, they really, you know, as a nation are kind of service-oriented and think about people in a pretty enlightened way.
Speaking of helping people, in 2015, Berkadia built a school in Hyderabad. You've got 180 kids today. Why did you do it? And tell us about the school.
Yeah, well, there's a law in India for multinational companies that some portion of your profits that are created in that country in India need to be dispersed in India. And that can be done in a bunch of different ways. You can donate to an NGO. You can do all sorts of things. But we were really interested in, and this was led by a man in our organization, Mark McCool. We were really interested in creating, you know, value for the community in which we were in Hyderabad. And so, you know, we searched out some opportunities, and we happened upon a fellow who started a bunch of different schools for different purposes. I think kind of some Votech schools and some other things that were helping people with employment. And one thing we noticed in the area where we were at is there was a lot of child labor. And these are, you know, a lot of families just need their children starting at very young ages. I mean, 6, 7, 8 years old to go out and work primarily manual labor, a lot of domestic, a lot of cleaning, a lot of, you know, light manufacturing, building, construction, stuff like that. And they would need that income in order to keep the family going. And so we had a, you know, a plan with this guy to put together some money and to identify a building that we could purchase or rent, and we would start a school where we could take these kids who are in these situations, and we could work with them in an intense way so that we could matriculate them back into their age level schooling and get them back into kind of the, you know, the normal system. And so, you know, what started with very few students ends up now, you wouldn't believe it, in the United States, we're putting 180 kids in an area that in the States you probably wouldn't educate 50. But they are all bright-eyed and eager, and we've had our first class graduate and kind of move into the normal system. And it's fantastic, and we are actually, as individuals and as a company, supporting that effort as much as we can.
What have the kids taught you, Justin?
You know, Jack, similar to kind of Madagascar for me, which is really where it kind of brought me back to, just how you can be happy, and it has nothing to do with your material situation. It has to do with, you know, some ideals like freedom and hope and growth and opportunity and those sorts of core things that I think as Americans especially we overlook the opportunity that we have. And to see it in kind of these kids' eyes, newly born, because they really were looking at a life of servitude and a life of desperation, and, you know, whose parents, these are certainly the first generation of people who are literate at any level, to see that and what that does to the human soul, that is life-changing.
For the first 20-plus years of your life, Justin, you lived on a farm in a very small town in Idaho, then Salt Lake City, and now you and your wife are in New York City, the Big Apple. What's that like?
Well, you know, I think for my wife and I, it was one thing. What I would say is for our kids, we have four kids, and the oldest was 15 when we moved. It was certainly something else. And, you know, my 15-year-old daughter, who was entering her sophomore year of high school, I think it was about 6 months before she talked to me after we moved out here. But now, you know, now she does look back on it and say it was a great thing for her. In fact, she plans to, when she finishes up her education, she plans to move back to the East Coast and live here. But you know, definitely a different, you know, a difference of a different speed, you know, a different kind of energy level and a different kind of focus. And a lot of folks on the East Coast are run at a very, very fast pace and are probably, you know, in our community certainly are type A type folks who are interested in success. But, you know, kind of the core human things of family and wanting to do things right and being, you know, basically honest and those sorts of things, we're certainly finding that here as well. And so I wouldn't tell anyone not to do it. I think, you know, people are people, and I think America is a wonderful place to be no matter where you live.
We're talking to Justin Wheeler, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Justin Wheeler, who's got a life story that's the American dream. Speaking of which, let's talk about some of your heroes. One, President Ronald Reagan. Why?
Well, you know, I'm sure it was a part of the era that I grew up in, but when he was elected in 1980, and that was when I turned 8 years old. And so for me, he really is the first president that I remember. But also he just had an innate optimism, that I thought was really special, where he could certainly had the gift of the tongue, the silver tongue, and had the ability to kind of be very folksy and played well to, you know, the folks of us who lived out west and came from a rural lifestyle. But he was really at the base, he was a very optimistic person. He believed that the American dream existed. He believed that we were the shining light, you know, the city on the hill. He really did have a fundamental belief in America and the values under which she was created. And that was something that resounded kind of in my heart, and it was something that I just loved about him. And he was really funny, and he would tell some great jokes that that really I used to enjoy a bunch. And still to this day, my kids once in a while will pull up some old YouTube videos and watch him make some comments and say sorts of things. Who could forget his call to tear down the wall and to end the Cold War? I mean, that was one of the most amazing moments in our history, let alone in my lifetime.
In your lifetime, you met a lot of people, and one was Lee Sutton. Tell us about Lee Sutton.
Well, this is kind of in the context, Jack, when you and I are talking about it, about heroes. And, you know, I remember being a small boy, and there was a, you know, in my town of 400 people or so, there was a coffee shop where the farmers gathered and you know, conducted their business and mostly kind of gossiped with each other and bemoaned the fact that, you know, there was a bad weather or the crop prices weren't any good. But I remember one time in particular sitting with my dad, and we were, you know, having a hamburger or something like that, and my dad turned and pointed at at a fellow who I knew well, who was one of my dad's friends, whose name was Lee Sutton. And Lee Sutton was a potato farmer, which in those days certainly meant, you know, wealth, and also meant huge risk, huge reward. These guys were either driving all brand new equipment or they were barely kind of scraping by. And I remember he was talking to someone I didn't recognize, and so I asked my dad, you know, who is that? And my dad said, that's a potato buyer. And he's just, you know, he's come to negotiate with Lee on buying his potatoes this year. And so as we're watching, the man stands up, and he and Lee shake hands, and the guy walks out the door. My dad turns to me, and I said, what just happened? Dad said, well, they just made a deal on probably, you know, close to $1 million worth of potatoes, which $1 million to me was unfathomable at the time. And he said, Justin, one thing I want to tell you, he said, they just sealed a deal for $1 million with a handshake. And he said, I hope someday that you'll be like Lee Sutton. And that to me was a very powerful moment where, you know, you realize that you can be just a simple farmer, but having integrity and doing what you say you're going to do counts a lot.
Berkadia is a 50-50 partnership with Berkshire Hathaway. So as such, you've had a bunch of interaction with a man named Warren Buffett. Tell us about Warren Buffett.
Well, one thing I have to say is I don't have a ton of interaction with Warren Buffett, but I will tell you one story, which is pretty entertaining. I was at Leucadia at the time when we bought Capmark and turned it into, or I was at Leucadia when we turned it into Capmark into Berkadia, and we had a executive retreat in Telluride, Colorado, and we asked Warren if he would come, which he graciously said he would, and so he came out to Telluride and met with our group, and I mean it's just an amazing opportunity for him to meet with our executives and their spouses and to just spend a little personal time, and I had the opportunity to drive him back to his airplane so that he could take off and go back to Omaha. And so as we're driving through the town of Telluride, I was like, what do I say to Warren Buffett when you're driving through the town? And I said, hey, I said, Warren, have you ever been to Telluride before? And he said, yeah. He said, it was one time, and I can't remember the exact date, but I mean, he quoted it. It was like, you know, June 5th, you know, 1984, and there's a golf course right up here, and he pointed to where the golf course was at, and he named the foursome that he was with, and he named, like, the yardage of the hole that he played. I mean, down to a yard, Jack. I mean, he really does have that kind of mental acuity that people, you know, talk about, but it's legendary, but it's actually, in his case, very true. And the other thing that was interesting about him is I watched him interact, and I've seen him do it a lot of times, or at least a handful of times, I should say. He can communicate with every person no matter what level they're on. He does not need to use big vocabulary words. He doesn't need to use, you know, fancy terms or fancy mathematics. He can talk to a person at their level, whether that was it's a farm kid like I am, all the way up to CEOs and scientists and whoever else, and communicate with them in a way that's very clear and lucid. And that's a total package that's really rare to find.
A couple of Warren Buffett quotes, if you will. First, you find out who was wearing a swimming suit when the water drains from the lake. Please.
Yeah, I just think that's brilliant. I mean, you know, a lot of people use our industry. Right now, commercial real estate and real estate at large is once again at all very, very high levels, and people are piling into investments, and people are, you know, everyone's kind of a self-proclaimed czar of real estate. Well, the cycle since 2008 has done nothing but go up, and in this cycle, you know, everyone can make money. But it's when the cycle turns and when, you know, interest rates go up and things start to and capital starts to flow in a different direction, that's when we're going to find out who actually made good investments and who was smart and who was just riding the wave. And, you know, that happens kind of in everywhere. It happens in life. You know, we often get over our skis of who we think we are, how powerful we think we are, how smart we think we are. But it's kind of in the adversity, the times of adversity or when the times aren't so good, that we really find out who we are. And so I just think that phrase has such great applicability, not just economically, but also personally.
Another quote, it takes 20 years to build a reputation and 5 minutes to ruin it. If you think about that, you'll do things differently.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how much I can add to that, but I think it's very powerful, and it's something that we, as an organization at Berkadia, we talk about it a lot. We say, you know, we take the long view. It's one of our core values, and I think it's one of our strategic advantages, which is, you know, let's not worry about this transaction today. Let's worry about, you know, the next 20 years of what we're trying to build, and let's make our decisions based on that. And if we do that, we're going to treat the client fine. They're going to like us. They're going to prefer us. Over time, we may, you know, not make as much money on this transaction, or we may, you know, take it in the teeth a little bit, but it's going to, over the long haul, it's going to build a better company, and it's going, and it's also a company where we are going to attract the kind of people that we want to work with. And it's about having that long-term view.
30-plus years ago, Mary Kay Ash, the founder of Mary Kay Cosmetics, told me, Jack, P&L not only stands for profit and loss, but P&L stands for people and love. 35 years later, Justin, is that still true in business today?
Yeah, no, I certainly so, yes. But what I think sometimes people get the wrong view of that. So let's just talk about that. You know, at Berkadia, there are times when because of an employee's, you know, certain actions, or just because the business, you know, changes, where there's disruption, and there might be the need for someone to exit our company. Now, you know, some people will say, oh, if you care about people and it's about love, you know, you would never let someone go, or you would never have a hard, you know, performance conversation with someone. You just tell them how awesome they are. And I actually think of that in a completely different way, which is, what is good for people? People deserve good feedback. They deserve to know when they're doing a good job and when they're not, and why that is, and what they can do to improve. People deserve to know if their skills are getting rusty and if they need to go improve somewhere. There are some people who would actually be happier at other places because they don't recognize our values, they don't want to work in the way we want them to work, or they can't perform, whether that's voluntarily or involuntary. And it's better for us that we help people see that and help them to go to some place where they can be happy than it is to kind of have them around with both of us avoiding each other. And so one of the things that we really try to do as a company is, if you really care about people, and you know, we say at Berkadia, people matter, that means that you're honest with them and that you're giving them good feedback and that you're helping them make the best decisions for them and for the company.
Justin Wheeler, you are a shining example of a great servant leader. Keep up the great, great work.
Thank you, Jack. Appreciate it.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Small.
Believe in yourself.